This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Dunedin, Otapoti Dunedin, and I am joined by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. You spent the weekend up a mountain.
I did. I took 9 Whakatani high school kids who joined another 11 rangatahi from other communities for Duke of Edinburgh Bronze Award. So we were at Ruapehu and Tongariro in the National Park and just had the best time. Do you know what, Sam? It's so long since I've experienced a proper frost and I was running around like a little kid breaking puddles with my boots. It was so fun. I forgot how much fun it is to break puddles.
Is there a Duke of Edinburgh Parents Award?
There should be. There should be, but I love it because I get to be camp cook, so cooking for all the 20 kids and the adult helpers and the old golds that were there, and just totally in my element. And I love it, you know, like the opportunity to just spend time with these kids and see them living their best life. It's amazing. Yeah, because Jack's finished now, so I'm now the award leader, and Jack's gone. As he finished his gold.
That was quick.
I got sucked in. Once they suck you in, they never let you go.
Being sucked into a thing that means you get to go up a mountain and stay there for the weekend sounds all right.
It's pretty blooming good, I have to say. And it was like having a holiday. I mean, I work hard when I'm up there feeding everybody, but it's a holiday for me.
Indeed. Yeah. And who are we introducing today?
Speaking of amazing people from amazing places, it is my great pleasure to introduce Paulina Barry, science communicator and ecologist. Welcome, Paulina. It is joyful to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Paulina graduated. There was a picture of her in the paper.
Oh, congratulations.
There was, yeah. American twins graduate together. It was quite cute. We were just walking from the graduation parade out to get lunch, and these photographers came and practically grabbed us, and it was quite a funny little impromptu photo shoot.
Where are you from?
My sister and I were from the United States. We're actually from Washington State, so the opposite of the other Washington, D.C.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, I wanted to be a zoologist and an artist, and I'm actually doing it, which is kind of cool.
Zoologist and artist. What was that? You had two different ideas and you've managed to pull them both off, or did you see it as being the same thing?
I always kind of saw it as the same thing. They can go in different directions, but you know, a lot of naturalists, a lot of ecologists, over the last 200 years or so, they've also been the ecology and the artistry goes hand in hand. A lot of these ecologists were also artists drawing what they saw in nature, and they try to be really accurate to make those connections. And It's just an extension of that today.
So is that what inspired you down that path?
Yeah. My family is really creative. The scientists of the Victorian age were created beautiful illustrations that I just pored over as a kid. We had all these artistic science books I would just stare at for the longest time. And my family really encouraged the artistry and loved that we love nature.
So have you trained in both?
Mostly just the science. My undergrad is in ecology. I took some art classes, but for the most part, I wanted to be really confident and competent in the science background. And I learned artistry mostly on my own and from family members. There's a lot of artists in my family.
Your degree in zoology's got I'm going to call it a strange name. Behavioral
and
concentration in behavioral anthrozoology.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is a bit different. It's not a course that's just offered at the Western Washington University. So there's Western Washington University's ecology program and environmental science program. But I decided to go to the college within the college called Fairhaven. And at Fairhaven College, instead of sort of that structured test-taking kind of academic experience, it's more of a writing-intensive focused thing with lots of feedback given and discussions. So if you're really good at test-taking and kind of that very systematic approach to learning, that's great. Fairhaven was for the people who had a different way of thinking with a lot of writing and discussion. And you had the option to pick and choose courses from all over the university departments and create your own program. And that's where anthrozoology came from.
That sounds like
I should explain it, shouldn't I? Yeah, yes. So anthrozoology is the study of how humans interact with animals, vice versa, and how we interact with the natural world around us, how we see ourselves in nature, things like that. It can get quite philosophical.
And what attracted you to New Zealand?
New Zealand. I always heard about it growing up, this unique, faraway place at the end of the world with kiwis and kakapo. And I'm from Seattle, and you can't see the night sky, which is a bummer from all the light pollution. And there's so many people. It's about 5 million people in Seattle. And I was really interested in New Zealand, partly because it was something completely different that I've never experienced before. So when I came here in 2019 with my sister, we went woofing and we volunteered at different family homes, working on small permaculture farms. And we're volunteering for DOC on different conservation projects. And I felt like I could do something good here. I felt so small in the United States, and I felt like I could actually do something here. So that's why I wanted to come back for my master's degree.
And what was your master's on?
My master's is in science communication from the University of Otago. And I studied how people think about animal extinction and how we've historically responded to animal extinctions, especially the ones that humans have had a part in causing, and how we grieve for certain species, how we forget others, and how we're dealing with the idea of the sixth mass extinction.
It's interesting how selective we are. We get very passionate about the big furry ones and really don't care about the little scurry ones. Is that explainable? Is it justified? How do you see that?
Yeah, that's one of the things I looked into. I looked up what extinctions occurred that were recorded between, let's see, it was 2010 to 2019. There were about 160 extinctions in that time, but most of them were small little critters. Nobody really remembers the bean snail, but we do sort of remember the West African black rhinoceros, right? That was 2016, I believe. And I think part of the reason we forget some species and remember others is sort of cultural value of a species. Big animals we can see and we can interact with. Oftentimes they're a food resource or a powerful symbol. But if it's a very small animal, especially invertebrates, they're kind of out of sight, out of mind. And animals that have high cultural value or high resource value, particularly, are going to be paid more attention to, because animals that are used as a resource are part of our culture and part of our way of life. So when they go missing, that's a part of your culture missing too.
It's interesting. I've always used as an example the trolley problem. You know, the trolley's down, going running down the track, train is running down the track, and extending, and you know, you've got the control of the train, and it is going to kill five people on the track, or you can divert it and kill only one person, and extending that in space and time, and saying, okay, let's say we can divert it into a forest. And it's going to run over some trees. And okay, there's a solution for us. But then we say, but it's going to, is another alternative, it's going to run over the last remaining orangutan. And all of a sudden, you know, how does that change things? And then comparing that to saying, okay, it's, instead of that, it's going to run over some sort of snail. But that snail, we don't care about. Unless it potentially might contain the cure for cancer.
Mm. Yeah, that's that cultural and resource value, right?
Yeah.
If the my snail favorite, can cure cancer, that's very highly valued, right?
My favorite twist on that is to say, okay, let's put the train into a space-time loop and say that it's going to go off into the clouds and come back in 10 years, but when it does, it's going to kill 1,000 people. And I've used that example for a long time. And every time I've done it, giving a lecture, I've thought at that point, oh, phew, that's the one I'll pick. And that's just insane. And I'm using it to show, you know, how these decisions are difficult. But that decision shouldn't be on the table in 10 years. It's still us. It's not even some sort of distant descendants. But pushing that further away means that I don't need to worry about it.
A lot of people have trouble thinking about these big existential things because they are scary, and we won't be around.
Let's take some music. Let's take Jane with Come. Why this one?
Jane is an artist that I really like. She's got a different kind of style to her. This South African French menagerie, really unique. She's one I still listen to after like 10 years.
you to work today, instead of the day. Karma, karma, baby, karma, we got off your nightmares. Karma, karma, baby, karma, we live as forever. Jada, jada, karma, karma, baby, karma, we not let you go.
Being a science communicator in these complex times must have its real challenges. I have the great joy of working with rangatahi at the moment, particularly around climate change, sea level rise, and vertical land movement. But the thing that comes up all the time is animal species. And if you're talking to kids about what they can do to protect and conserve what we have, what do you say to them? What's your advice?
Well, in the context of New Zealand, for Aotearoa New Zealand, there are some very specific and fairly easy things that regular people and children can do to help the wildlife around thrive. New Zealand's got a really unique ecology, but its problems are really well understood for the most part. So planting native plants, getting really familiar with native plants, especially to your region, and learning about the history of native plants in your area, the natural history, is really good to see what was here like 300 years ago and plant plants that might have been here. Trapping is another thing that's really good for children to do. Households to do, to have rat traps that also trap, possums or hedgehogs, because those animals like to eat the eggs and all the invertebrates that other species like skinks and geckos and birds rely on. Those are the two biggest things, native plants and trapping, but also just getting to know what kind of animals are around you that are native. And learning about some of the pitfalls that people trying to do the right thing can fall into when trying to encourage wildlife. Because like things like birdseed, you think would be good for people to put out in their yards, right? Birdseed helps feed the birds, but New Zealand birds, the native ones, don't actually eat birdseed. So if you put birdseed out in your yard, you're actually feeding exotic species like starlings and magpies. Which don't get along all that well with some of the native species. But yeah, it's thinking about which species you want to encourage in your life and around, and which species you don't necessarily want to encourage.
I had a little giggle the other day talking to some kids about possums. Told them that it took 5 attempts to get possums to establish in Aotearoa, and it wasn't until we had enough fruit trees also introduced that we could get the possums introduced and thriving as they are. And then I was reading that the government is currently trying to put through some legislation to protect wapiti species in Fiordland, and I just despair at that. But talking to the kids about that and helping them to understand why those pest species were introduced in the first place and how much thinking has changed. And they asked me if I could go back in time and stop one species from coming in, what would that be? So that's my question for you. If you could stop one species from being introduced, what would it have been?
That's a really good question. It's tempting to say people, but I'd rather just delay people, because then we would still have MOA, right? But But no, I would probably say rats. Rats are the number one that I would say. I wish we didn't introduce, because they're so hard to control wherever they are released out in the world. My second choice would be cats, though.
Yeah, I would be totally in agreement with you. Rats and cats, I would be very happy. I love having border terriers because I do not have a rat or cat problem in my yard.
Ah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, those are so good. Where does your hopefulness come from when you think about this generation of young people that are coming through? Because I find them to be quite a hopeful group. Have you observed that, and what do you think it is? What's their magic?
Yeah, no, I there's definitely a lot of positivity. You know, Gen Z and Gen A are highly, like, super connected to each other via social media. And despite all of the misinformation online and the rabbit holes and the pitfalls, the level of communication between young people all over the world is incredible. And they can know what's up on the other side of the planet while it's happening. And then they can take action by communicating with each other. And there's a lot of power in that. But also there's still a lot of curiosity. And there's a lot of energy about our ecosystems. People are getting back into nature. They're tired of using their phones as toys and are shifting, hopefully, towards using them as tools instead. And we can also use the tech for learning more about where we live, the natural world. And it can help us connect, like iNaturalist. Is a really good tool for learning about where you live. And it's also a bit of a social media too, because it's just social media for plant ID and animal ID, and then you can connect through that too. So there's a lot of, I think there's just a lot of energy. And for people who are really interested in learning deeply about nature, it's available.
Do you think that, my perception is that adults seem to be so susceptible to misinformation and disinformation. Do you think our kids are as naive as their parents and grandparents when it comes to this stuff?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. The misinformation technology and the way that it happens keeps evolving. And we always have to keep up as it evolves. And we're always going to be behind because that technology is always improving on ways to make itself more convincing, right?
Do you encounter it very much?
Sorry?
Do you encounter it very much? And, you know, when you're talking to people, and in particular to young people?
I see my older friends and family probably being fooled by AI images of animals and feel-good stories more often than I see young people falling for those stories. I think there is a certain level of, maybe naivety about some of these fake images. Just like when digital art first started becoming really popular, people couldn't tell the difference between a regular photo and a photoshopped one. Now it's really easy to tell for most people, but with AI, it's definitely harder, and it's getting better. But I still think young people are getting tricked by it a lot, and I do fear that because of algorithms, there's a little bit less agency with our time spent on the internet, because all of this information is just getting fed to you, and it's personalized instead of. When I was growing up, you did actually have to think of an idea and look it up. And you might have gotten misinformation in your search bar, but you still had to take the step to type it in and search instead of just being fed.
I find it alarming now that if I do go looking for something on Google, that Google AI will actually give me an AI answer before it gives me any pages to look at.
Yeah.
And I see that... That bothers me, and this is quite new, like only in this year probably that that's been happening. But so how do you talk to kids about that? How do you get them to think about being safe in the information that they're being fed via the internet?
Well, I've mostly just thought about this on my own. When I'm working with children out in nature, I try to keep technology as far away as possible, because a lot of them are spending a lot of time on screens at home. So when we're out in nature, I just try to get people to look at what shapes and colors and textures are around them, what sounds the birds are making, and think about what they're saying to each other. But if I was going to tell have a discussion about children and learning about how to navigate the internet space, I would say that there is agency to be had. You can tailor your internet experience by learning a little bit of coding, some scripts. Adding scripts and extensions to your browsers can reduce the amount of ads you see. It can remove a lot of distractions and a lot of like attention grabbing things that just suck your attention. So there is a way to curate your internet experience so that there's less distractions and less information that you don't want to see to get to the real stuff. But it takes a learning curve, and I've had to learn that learning curve too. I'm not a coder, but I could never browse the internet without my filters, because it's just too much.
Yeah, it amazes me that our kids do as well as they do. And having just spent, a weekend on the mountain with all these rangatahi, some of them literally walked looking at screens. And the look of anxiety on their faces when you say, "Can you put your phone in your pocket?" It absolute terror of, "Oh my gosh, but then I'm disconnected." And it's quite interesting. So how do we bring kids back to nature when we put them in nature and they still won't let go of the screen?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I've seen this as well. There's a very safe, it's a very safe feeling. It's like having a safety blanket to have your phone. I've seen children be terrified of the plants and animals around them in real life, but then they're okay looking at those same things if it's on a screen. So if the screen is a level of distance from the real thing that keeps you safe. So I suppose some children are uncomfortable with the amount of stimulation that the wor real world brings, because it's not always safe. But it's also exciting and real. So I don't know. I suppose gentle exposure and reducing technology use and it's just like building a skill or building a muscle to gradually be okay without the phone.
But isn't the phone and taking pictures with the phone the modern day equivalent of setting up with your sketchpad?
Well, I've never done that. Never thought about it. I suppose taking photos is a great way to connect with nature and the people around you. But if you're taking an iPad out with an Apple Pen and you want to sketch on your Apple or on your tablet, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, there's ways to integrate technology into your experiences out in nature, for sure.
Let's take the second of your music choices. Let's have Chapel Rowan, Pink Pony Club. I don't think I've ever said the phrase Pink Pony Club. Why the Pink Pony Club?
It's a really popular song right now, and I like the song. I hear it all the time. Being queer and in the queer community, it's kind of an iconic song that everybody loves. It's always playing in certain spheres. And it's an iconic song of our generation for the queer community, and that's why I like it.
Thank you. I know you wanted me to stay, but I can't ignore the crazy visions of me in LA. And I heard that there's a special place where boys and girls can all be queens every single day. I'm having wicked dreams of leaving Tennessee. If Santa Monica, I swear it's calling me, will make my mama proud. It's gonna cause a scene. She sees her baby girl, I know she's gonna scream. God, what have you done? You're a pink pony girl, and you dance at the club. Oh, mama, I'm just having fun on the stage in my heels. It's where
you relatively famously in Dunedin painted the side of a building.
I did, yeah.
With extinct animals. Yes. Birds, to be precise.
Yes, I talked earlier about my thesis being about how we process extinction events, and I zoomed in on New Zealand's extinct species. So the first part of my thesis was kind of this philosophical, historical research on that. And then the second part of my thesis was to practice some science communication. And I painted in the past, and I've been interested in murals in the past, so I wanted to bring this topic to people in a creative way. And I chose street art partly because I had already was already interested in doing street art, but also because street art is so highly accessible and public. And the topic of extinction is not something that a lot of people want to address or think about unless you're already interested in it. But I do think that knowing that these species, these animal species existed, they were here in New Zealand and they're part of the natural history of this place. I think everybody should be able to have that information, whether they're searching for it or not. It's interesting. And I feel like these species should not be forgotten necessarily, but to recognize that they were here and that it was mostly the actions of people living here that caused their extinctions also. So the mural is in Dunedin. It's on the zoology building of the University of Otago. And it's got several extinct New Zealand species, not all of them, but a good number of them. Yeah.
I like that idea of whether they're searching for it or not, because that's one of the big challenges that sustainability has, is that people would rather not know. People would rather carry on having the party that they're already having. How do we communicate to people that don't want to know?
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to bring information forward so that people who aren't already interested can get informed. I chose street art, one, because street art has a history of bringing difficult topics to the street. And it's totally free to witness. And sometimes it's annoying to see. A lot of us don't like graffiti, but graffiti sometimes has fair messages in it. And street art has typically used a lot of social justice issues, bringing those to light. And environmental issues are becoming more common in street art around the world. So I decided to be a part of that. But yeah, climate change and biodiversity loss are big existential issues that are difficult to process. And they're often presented in sort of a doomsday fashion, which is not entirely helpful either, because the point isn't to make people feel like we're doomed. But when I talk about extinction and when I do extinction art, when I was painting the mural, a lot of people came up to say thank you. And they expressed that they had this horrible feeling about biodiversity loss and extinctions. But they don't get enough acknowledgement that there's a problem out in the real world, out in their lives. So they were really happy to see a really big painting acknowledging the species that have gone extinct, because it was sort of cathartic in a way, that you're recognizing that pain. Because when species do go extinct, there is a pain felt. And part of that is just one step to building up resilience and fighting that is acknowledging that pain collectively.
Unfortunately, most of our attempts to not reverse extinction, but to try and prevent it happening, end up being very expensive and putting things into conservation type modes. We're not very good at the changing the system in the first place that's pushing it into there. How do we, clearly we need both, but how do we shift it to that systems change rather than, oh, phew, that species is looked after, it's on an island somewhere and we don't need to worry about that anymore. Meanwhile, let's carry on bulldozing or doing whatever it is we're doing to where they should be living.
Yeah, that's a big task. It's also almost, if I had to think about it, it's a really big topic. I'm reminded of the first recorded extinction that I found in my research, which was written down by a guy called Pliny the Elder about 2,000 years ago in ancient Rome. He noticed that this very popular medicinal plant started disappearing from the hills. And it was mostly because the agricultural and collection of these of this plant started shifting away from that use and trading that. And the shepherds started intensely grazing the fields with sheep. And that caused a damage to the ecosystem where this plant could no longer grow. And Pliny the Elder, 2,000 years ago in ancient Rome, attributed this extinction to this plant to people, and specifically to profit seeking. 2,000 years ago. And even back then, people saw that overconsumption was an issue. And today, that issue is still a problem. I think there's a lot of people in the world who could use, we could just produce less stuff. And I don't think anybody would be less happy. And I think that that a lot of production is the cause of deforestation, of forests, and the lowering quality of habitat overall. Just taking too much and making too much stuff. We could all just kind of chill out a little bit for a while. And I think that would do a lot of good. Like when I hate to say this, but when the pandemic first started, the airports were pretty silent, and there was a lot less pollution because of it. And I'm not saying that what happened during the pandemic was good for the environment. There was a lot of ups and downs and a lot of blowbacks, and the ecology is really complicated. So our lack of activities in some areas produced better results for environmental ecosystems, but other things actually hurt the environment. What that does tell me is that people have a huge impact on the ecosystems and places that we live in, because we're a part of it all. We're not separate from nature by any means. We just think we are.
As you say, that's a big topic, and you did a big painting. Was it interesting scaling a painting up so much?
Yeah, it was.
Because normally what would have done, well, moving your fingers, was not even just an arm stroke, it was a crane stroke.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so what I did was I finally got the wall, the perfect wall, on this Zoology building, and I took a photo of it as from across the street. And then I actually designed the painting in Photoshop with the photograph of the wall in the background, so I could get the right shape and proportions. And the wall is great. It already has this grid on it with these tiles, which helps me grid out the design on the wall. And then from there, you could just sort of wing it.
I have some questions to end the show, and not very much time, so we're going to have to wriggle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oh, I think painting that wall was my biggest success. It was the biggest project I've ever done, and I really enjoyed working with the other science communication staff and students. We were a pretty tight knit community, and without all of them helping me to bring this crazy idea to life, you know, it wasn't just me who did it, that's for sure. I had a lot of help, and that's a success for me, is that we got to work together on a project and make it actually happen.
What's your superpower?
Mine? Tenacity. I've been told tenacity is my superpower.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I don't think I do enough necessarily to be called an activist. I'm not really in the protest scene necessarily. I I'm an ecologist and I really care deeply about the environment. And I'm an artist, so I do create art about the environment. But I do see myself more as an educator than an activist. But I do really appreciate the work that activists do.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Coffee. No, I love doing art. Going for hikes up at Mount Cargill, experiencing New Zealand's nature, that's what motivates me.
And what's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
Well, I'm really excited to do a lot more murals, and they're all environmental themed. They're all about New Zealand's wonderful wildlife. And I'm doing them out in Ranfurly and in Coromandel, and they're highlighting species that are threatened or rare or endangered. And sometimes people in the communities don't know a lot about the endangered species around them. So I hope that people can learn about them through my artwork and then learn more after that.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
Oh, I would decrease. I would wish for a reduction in the rate of extinction. That's what I would do, because it should be very low, like one extinction per decade. But we're at 160 per decade, and that rate is just too high.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Advice? Go for a walk every day if you can.
Yep. Let's do that. Let's do that now. But first, Mawira.
Paulina, I have so much admiration for science communicators. I think that you are all angels. Just with invisible halos and wings. You are where the hopefulness for this coming generation comes from, because without education and understanding and the tools that you give them, then where can the hope come from? I am so thankful to you and your group, your graduands who all graduated at the same time as you, for making this commitment to making the world a better place. And so thank you, and we wish you all the best with the journey ahead. Kia ora.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Thank you for joining us. We're going out to Big Yellow Taxi.
City paradise, put up a parking lot. A pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah. Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on the apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh, bah, 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 bah. Ooh, bah, 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 bah.
Late last night.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. Mawira and I were joined today by Paulina Barry. I'm Samuel Mann. Oh, that was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Bye.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.